Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Now, if you're a child of the 80s or the 90s, name Mark Summers probably conjures memories of jumping through obstacle courses made from living room furniture as Doubledare played on the TV in the background. At least it does for me. But as you will hear in this podcast, Mark's work goes well beyond the Nickelodeon show. He has had almost a 50-year career as a performer, producer, comic, host, and entertainer. I was so happy to talk to Mark on the podcast. He's a great storyteller, and we speak about his upcoming show, The Life and Slimes of Mark Summers, at the Alleyway Theater, September 9th through September 30th. Tickets are available at alleyway.com. And if you act fast, some of the VIP front row Slime Zone seats might still be available. It was a childhood dream come true to talk to Mark, and I hope you enjoy our talk as much as I did. Mark Summers, thank you so much for being with me today. It's great to connect with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing really well. So I'd love to ask you, have you ever been to Buffalo before?
I have. Back in the Doubledare Nickelodeon tour days, we played Buffalo several times.
That's amazing. Well, I'm sure that people are going to be thrilled to see you back in Buffalo with your solo show. Can you tell us a little bit about the format of your solo show? How is it different than, let's say, other maybe solo shows?
We have a lot of audience participation. You know, a lot of people grew up watching me be at the Food Network or Doubledare, but Nickelodeon obviously was sort of two generational kind of program. And people always dreamed of getting on stage, doing a physical challenge, maybe running the obstacle course. And so within the body of the show, we give a couple of people opportunities to get on stage and do things such as that.
That's amazing. Some of my fondest memories as a kid reminds me of like my sister sort of like flipping over the ottoman and doing like, you know, the sort of final physical challenges as that was happening. And I'm like, Suzanne, you've got to come and check out Mark Summers' show. And so she's definitely going to try to come up and get it. So your show also kind of, in addition to sort of the format being different, though, also goes into your life, right? And sort of tells your life story.
Step by step, it does, for better or for worse. And it's all 100% true. The ups and downs. I'm doing a podcast now called Mark Summers Unwraps. And the reason I did it was people go to a Broadway show or go to a movie or watch a TV show and say, boy, the person who's starring in that is so lucky. And what they don't realize is what people go through to get from point A to point B. You don't just, you know, end up on Broadway or end up on a TV show. From the time I landed in Los Angeles until I got Doubledare was 13 years. And the question is, why do some people pursue it and some people with their passion get their final goals and other people just give it up? I had a friend once say, I'm going to come out to LA for 6 weeks and give it a shot. And I said, don't bother, because nothing's going to happen in 6 weeks unless you're the luckiest human in the world. So, yeah, we talk about growing up in Indiana, making my transition into Boston, how I got to Los Angeles and the ups and downs of trying to become a TV host.
It's so often, right, we think of kind of the old Lana Turner story of like sitting at Schwab's drugstore and being discovered. But the reality is you really need to kind of continually discover yourself.
Well, that's a great statement. That's very, very true. And certainly even more relevant because I talked a bit about Bob Barker in my one-man show, in that my first real job was as a writer on Truth or Consequences, the show that he did for about 20 years, first on NBC and then in syndication. And I felt I had died and gone to heaven at age 22 to rub elbows with this guy and hang out with him a couple of days a week while we were shooting. And we became friends. He actually introduced at a tape I was making at the Magic Castle. And he was a producer with a development deal at CBS. And he called me to write questions for his show. And I don't know that anybody was truly close with Bob, but at one point we were pretty close, had an interesting relationship. And right up till pretty close till the end, I would always call him in December for his birthday and wish him well. It's not like we hung out together, but we had an interesting relationship.
Yeah, no, it's amazing who you can meet and how kind of the path sometimes forward in any kind of career in the arts really is sort of unexpected turns, or you're writing on this and then that leads to this and then that kind of opens up to that. Yep. I'd love to know, I'm sure that people, I mean, I definitely was, right, really excited to meet you. Do they all tell you sort of Doubledare or sort of childhood stories? Are there things that are all sort of, do they share things with you when you meet them?
Yeah, when we do the meet and greets, when I was doing the tour, everybody's got a story. Yeah, whether it was building an obstacle course in their living room and getting yelled at by their parents, or having a birthday party where they did Double Dare, or they came to see me and bring out a picture when they were six with my arm around them. It was interesting how that show affected so many folks. And Nickelodeon was very smart in their research and found out that kids were living vicariously through their parents watching Price is Right and a little bit of Wheel of Fortune. And they didn't have their own game show at the time. This was, 1986 when we launched. And so they provided that. And it was a combination of, getting messy when your parents tell you to stay clean all the time. We're rewarding you for getting messy. And the fact that they can win prizes and money and go to space camp or win a computer, which at the time was revolutionary. We struck a nerve. It's funny to go on somebody online. If you Google, prizes from Double Dare, somebody put together a 10-minute clip of some of the weirdest things we gave away. At the time, they weren't weird. But when you look back at them 30 plus years later, it was pretty peculiar. But right place, right time. We were on at 5:30 in the evening. Mom would say, go watch your show and I'm going to finish making dinner. So there were a lot of magical things going on at the time.
How do people react to the sort of mix of your story kind of mixed in with this? Are they surprised? Do they know a lot about you? Do they not? You've had a really fascinating life.
Some people know a lot. For whatever reason, there are, and I say this in the nicest possible way, game show geeks who kind of what I was, Bob Barker was my idol when I was growing up, Gene Rayburn, people like that. And there are people who have wishes and desires to be game show hosts, and they do so much research. I was a guest speaker at a 75th anniversary of game shows 2 weeks ago, and there with Bob Eubanks and a bunch of folks. And it's interesting what people have to say. But yeah, some people are surprised. I talk about overcoming OCD, getting cancer, getting in a car accident, and breaking every bone in my face. We sort of touch on many different parts of my life. And bottom line is how I keep getting up and, doing my thing.
Well, we're so glad you are. I can think about sort of, I've read that the genesis of the life and science of Mark Summers happened at a summer theater where you're sort of connecting with people. Can you maybe share that story with our listeners?
Yeah, I went to see Fiddler on the Roof on my 1964 confirmation trip for my synagogue in Indianapolis Hebrew congregation. And we went to see Fiddler on the Roof, and I'd never seen a Broadway show. And that touched me in such a way. And I just remember saying, how do I get to do something like that? So in the back of my head, I always wanted to go to New York and be on Broadway. And as I got older and found out what little talent I had in that world, I figured, well, that's never going to happen. And fast forward the tape, I get cancer and then I'm in a car accident. Somebody said to me, in fact, it was Bruce Valanche, who said to me, stop talking about it and do it. Ever since I've known you, you've always said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. You never have. Just do it already. And I used to go see the producers like almost every night in New York because I was living back there at the time. Mm-hmm. And there was a restaurant next door called Angus McKindo's. And it was owned by Matthew Broderick and Mel Brooks.
A legendary theater hangout spot in New York.
Yes. And so every night on the third floor, all the Broadway people would go up there after 11 o'clock at night. And no matter what I did, I could not get up there because I knew that's where all the talent was and where all the connections would be. But they blocked my entrance all the time. And one night I somehow powered my way past. And I was sitting at the bar and a guy came up to me and he said, I could have been you. And I said, I have no idea what that means. And he said, well, I auditioned for Double Dare and I didn't get the part. And I said, well, what do you do now? And he said, well, I produce Broadway shows. I said, well, I'd love to have a conversation with you because that's what I'd like to do. And we exchanged numbers and he had just taken over a summer theater in Long Beach Island, New Jersey.
Oh, Surflight. Yeah.
Surflight, 100%. And he called me and said, we're going to be doing Grease. Would you like to play Vince Fontaine? And I said, do I have to audition? He said, no, the part is yours. I said, done.
Offer so, only. Yeah.
Yes. And so I was a nervous wreck because I knew I was out of my element. And I was there with a bunch of kids. They're young 20s who grew up watching me and couldn't have been more supportive. And I'm still friends with many, many, many of them. And Vince Fontaine is only in a couple of scenes. And I was backstage with a guy by the name of Drew Gasparini, who very talented guy and a writer of music, and it's just amazing. And we stayed very close. And he said, you got to meet my friend Alex Brightman. And so Brightman and Gasparini and I used to hang out in New York. And I finally said, I'd like to do a one-man show. And Brightman said, well, that'll never happen because you're not compelling enough. And I said, what the hell does that mean? And I said, I don't think you know the whole story. So I started to give my story. And for the next 12 to 18 months, once a week, a couple times a month at least, Drew and Alex and I would go and have dinner and they would just ask me questions and I would tell them stories about my life. Yeah. And they were, for some reason, mesmerized by the people I interacted with and some of the things I did. And Alex then after those conversations, a year later, handed me a script and said, here it is, The Life and Slimes of Mark Summers. And they had just got done doing a show in Bloomington, Indiana, at a place called Bloomington Playwrights Project. Mm-hmm. And Chad Rabinowitz, who ran that place, said as they were walking out the door, if you have anything else you want to do, give me a call. And they said, we're doing a one-man show with Mark Summers. And Chad said, I'll take it. Sight unseen. And the next thing I know, I'm in Bloomington, Indiana, rehearsing for a couple of weeks and then doing the show for about a month. And then we did a thing called Adirondack Theater Festival, and it went very well, 300-seater, sold out every night. And then we were trying to get it to other places, and potentially the goal is off-Broadway, and then something called COVID happened, and everything came to a screeching halt. And so when I got the phone call a year or so ago saying, you want to do it again, I thought to myself, wow, I kind of do, but I'm a lot older and I don't know that I can memorize this stuff, and I'm not sure I can do this. And I guess I can, because we just got done doing some performances in Mount Gretna, Pennsylvania. And as we head to Buffalo, we're doing 17 shows over the month of September. And, you know, the goal is still to get it off Broadway. We'll see if that happens. But it's a lot of work. I pour my guts out on stage every night, sometimes twice a day because of matinees. And I tend to break down different places a couple of times during the show. And so it's emotionally taxing. And yet I think when I wrote the book on OCD about my life, and people stop me and say, I didn't know what I had until I read your book or till I saw you on Oprah. And thank you, because it changed my life. So I think part of my mission is to inform people of what it is I've, and how it may give them ideas on how they can improve their lives.
Well, and how exciting for, you know, the citizens of Buffalo to see your show, right, before it could go on to kind of be a huge sort of off-Broadway hit, fingers crossed, right? I understand that sort of some of your earlier inspirations were as a magician, which kind of ended up leading you to working at the Magic Castle. Is that correct?
Yeah, I moved to Los Angeles in 1973, and I became a regular at the time. I was doing generally 2 weeks a month, doing four shows a night, seven nights a week, for a whopping $145, but it was great training for me, and it got me on stage and got me to sort of learn how to perform, because up to that, I was just learning my way, as we all, you got to start somewhere, and I was playing little tiny clubs in Boston when I was going to school, and a guy by the name of Peter Pitt helped form my act, and that opened up some doors, and the next thing I knew, I was auditioning at the Comedy Store in 1976 when I became a regular. And so Magic was the introduction, but I was opening for Gallagher at a place called The Laugh Stop in somewhere, Hermosa Beach, I think it was, or maybe it was Newport Beach. And he said, how much are you getting open for me? And I said, $150. And he said, that's because you're a novelty act, which coming from Gallagher was kind of funny.
Our listeners, Gallagher used to smash sort of pineapples and watermelons as part of the comedy act. Yeah,
exactly. And I found out that as a stand-up, just doing comedy, he got paid $300 a week. But because I was a magician, I was only getting $150 a week. And I slowly started to wean myself off of the magic tricks and just started doing stand-up. And my salary increased, and it gave me an opportunity to open. I opened for a group called the Bay City Rollers at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, and was doing more gigs like that as opposed to just doing magic tricks.
And so this, your love of magic, though, kind of went through your life where you actually brought it to the sort of Mark Summers or Mystery Magical special that ran on Nickelodeon for many, many years that was actually filmed at the Magic Castle, right?
It was. And a guy by the name of Stan Allen, who I've been friends with for probably 50 years, we wrote it and produced it together. And at the time, Lance Burton was a new kid on the block. He did it with us. And, you know, Nickelodeon should still play it. When we brought back Double Dare a couple of years ago, I told them to look at it. They said it looked dated. It doesn't. They're wrong. But they're wrong about a lot of things. But nonetheless, it would still play. It still worked. And that thing is in so many minds of people. And I hear about it on a regular basis. And you can see it online if you Google it.
Yeah, no, it's sort of, I feel like it's burned into my memory. It felt like, oh, Halloween is here when it comes on.
Yeah, they ran it every year for like 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely remember every year kind of it coming up and being like, ah, the season's here. Perfect. I got to choose my costume. It seems like you've been working nonstop for over 30 years, and you're someone who has worked at all different kinds of levels and different kinds of jobs, be it producer, be it host, be it Vince Fontaine in the theater, right? What is the secret behind your hustle?
Well, that's a great question. By the way, it's frighteningly more like 50 years than 30 years. I moved to LA in 73. But I was doing magic on kids' TV shows and stuff, and I was on the radio from the time I was like 15.
Wow.
The whole show that I do, The Life and Slimes, talks about not accepting the word no, that it stops creativity and halts wonder. And it never affected me when somebody said, sorry, you're not getting the part. I thought, okay, well, you'll be fired soon. And the guy who takes your place will hire me and I'll just keep moving forward. I don't know if you're just born with that. I have no idea why I keep getting up after being knocked down, but I do. And it's worked for me. And I just don't understand why some people, when they're told no, sort of crawl up into a little ball and run away. I mean, it's just one person's opinion. And as they say, opinions are like, you know, the part in the parts of the back of your body. Everybody's got one
right.
Here. Yeah. And so I just keep moving forward. Nothing has stopped me. And I've been lucky enough to attain pretty much what I've wanted to do. I mean, the ultimate goal when I moved out in 73 was to take over the Tonight Show. That didn't happen. But, you know, half the fun is getting there. And the one thing about the entertainment industry is you don't have control of your life. Other people, casting directors, producers, they make those decisions. And sometimes there are things you really want to do, and sometimes they're not, but you do them anyway to hope to make connections and move on to the next step. So I just hope people watch it and get inspired and realize that one man or woman's opinion telling you you're not good enough means nothing.
Yeah. I think that is great advice for young performers. I know that you sort of act as both actor and sort of host of your solo show Coming to the Alleyway Theater. What do you think makes a good TV host? Because you are really excellent at it. So what do you think the secret sauce there is?
Well, that's kind of you. Bob Barker taught me to make the contestants the stars. He said, Mark, it's not about you. It's about them. And he says, you don't have to be funny every day. He said, if you get maybe one joke in on a Monday and maybe another one on Thursday, that's fine. But when I was working on Truth or Consequences and I sat over on the side and watched him select contestants and watch how he worked with contestants, it was like going to school for free. In fact, I was getting paid because I was a writer. And so I studied Barker. And then when I first got to LA, it was a page on Price is Right. So there I was at Contestants Row looking up at him and sort of putting all that stuff in the back of my head. And then I was a page on Match Game, and I watched how Gene Rayburn worked, you know, quite well, but in a different way than Barker did. I was never a fan of the just stand there and read cards kind of hosts. But, you know, Tom Kennedy was a really good host. There were a bunch of people out there who managed to pull it off. Of course, Johnny was a consummate host. Nobody was better than Carson, even to this day. I mean, Letterman, amazing, but in a different way. He emulated Johnny in a lot, but was unique. And I think that's the other thing. You have to be unique. For you to go out there and copy, when Robin Williams started the Comedy Store, all of a sudden there were 10 versions of Robin. And it's like, well, we don't need 10 versions of Robin. We already have the real deal. Anything else is going to pale to him. Same thing with Letterman hit it.
I mean, same thing with Gallagher and Gallagher 2.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And, you know, come up with your own concept. Come up with your own deal that makes you who you are and that makes people want to come and see you to, you know, bad impression of what's already successful will never work for you. It just doesn't.
You've been on stage, behind the camera, hosting, acting, across the gamut. What's your favorite medium in which to work, and why is that?
Well, live, in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I'm not, somebody recently asked me if I wanted to go back and do some stuff at the Comedy Store. The answer is absolutely not. It's a different audience these days, and the whole, back in the day, you could say and do almost anything. Now everybody gets offended if you look at them the wrong way. So I wouldn't want to go down that road. Mm-hmm. But certainly doing live theater and doing the, you know, Life and Slimes, you get instant gratification or not. But we've had great success with the audiences really falling in love with whatever it is we're doing, because I think we are different, because we have people come up on stage and because we walked down memory lane, of which a lot of folks remember because they were there as kids growing up watching it. And then they kind of open their eyes to find out what they didn't know. So live is always the best. The podcast is fun because they have people come to the studio. We've done a couple on Zoom and they just don't work as well. They need to be sitting across from you. And when we had Kevin Pollak on, or Howie Mandel, or, you know, Roker was the only one that really worked, in my opinion, where he was on Zoom, because he's a consummate broadcaster and knows how to do it. Mm-hmm. But sitting one-on-one is always the best way to do it. And you can sort of hear the reaction of the audience listening, even though they're not there.
That's fantastic. You know, I'd like to end here. I was lucky enough to speak to you for a different piece, and you were so generous. And, you know, you told a story about your early life and about sort of advice that a rabbi gave to you. I'd love to just sort of end here with just asking you to retell that story for these listeners, because they may have haven't had a chance to hear it.
Sure. When I got bar mitzvahed at the lovely age of 13, I all of a sudden thought, well, maybe I want to become a rabbi. And because being a rabbi is performing, whether people want to look at it or not, it's sort of entertainment-esque. And yet I had this passion for radio and television. And I just thought, well, my God, you know, I'm young, but what do I do? And Rabbi Weitzman, who was the assistant rabbi at our synagogue, from what I remember, went and studied radio and TV and then became a rabbi. So I rode my bike over to the synagogue in the afternoon after school and knocked on his door. And I said, "Do you have a minute to talk?" And he said, "Sure." So what can I do for you? And I said, "Well, you started off in radio and TV, didn't you?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "But you became a rabbi." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I kind of think I want to become a rabbi, but I'm not sure." And he said, "Well, why do you want to be a rabbi?" And I said, "I think because I can help people." And he said, "Well, here's the deal. As a rabbi, you can help a small amount of people a lot, but as an entertainer, you can help a lot of people a little. So I think whatever you decide would be good." And I took that information and got on my bike and rode back and pondered that for a few weeks and then decided, you know what? I think I want to be a performer full time. And that's how I made the decision. And I'm glad I did. Would I have been a good rabbi? Gosh, I have no idea. But I think that may be one of the hardest jobs ever, certainly doing the one-on-one and dealing with the ups and downs of people's lives. You're a psychologist, psychiatrist, you just have to do so many things. And it probably wasn't my forte. And I think what I'm doing is much better suited for me. And maybe I've been able to help, as Rabbi Weitzman said, more people this way than if I would have done the other choice.
Well, I can certainly say that you have definitely helped a lot of people in Buffalo who I know are going to come out and support your show. Mark, I'd like to just sort of end all my interviews by asking, is there anything that you feel left unsaid or anything you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I would appreciate it if people came out and watched the show and afterwards. Love to hang out and talk and get your reactions and find out, you know, what drove you to the theater and what was it about my past that intrigued you enough to spend a few bucks to sit there for 90 minutes and watch what I did. You know, come over, watch it. Let's talk afterwards and love to find out what your thoughts are.
Awesome. Mark Summers, thank you so much for chatting with me today. We will see you in Buffalo. All the ticket information will be on the website and at the end of this interview. Thank you so much. It was great chatting with you.
Same here, sir. Thanks for your hard work.
Well, that is our show for today. Mark was so generous with his time and answers. I could have talked to him all day. I'm really looking forward to seeing his show this fall. The Life and Slimes of Mark Summers will be at the Alleyway Theater September 9th through the 30th. Tickets are available at alleyway.com. Thanks from Western New York Soundstage and Buffalo Rising. Today's show was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmaker engineered this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted monthly on buffalorising.com. If you liked this show, please recommend it to a friend. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. We'll be back soon with more episodes where we will explore our local creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.